Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Look! A cat in a hat!
You will note I am neat. Wiped my feet on the mat.
Plenty of Dr. Seuss books became great cartoons and movies. But when Dr. Seuss made his own movie in 1953, things didn't go so well.
Come on and dress me, dress me, dress me in my peekaboo blouse.
I'm John Schaefer, and coming up on Soundcheck, with The Lorax scoring big at the box office, musician Michael Feinstein joins us to look back at a Dr. Seuss flop that became a cult classic, The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. Later, another underappreciated gem, the work of Spanish composer Xavier Monsalvache. Violinist Rachel Barton Pine and pianist Jenny Lynn join us to play some of his music live in our studio. All of that on Soundcheck after the news.
10 little dancing maidens dancing oh so fine. 10 happy little fingers and they're mine, all mine.
Before The Lorax spoke for the trees, even before The Grinch stole Christmas, there was The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today on the show, the story of a famous movie flop and the superfan who spent 30 years tracking down its score and songs. Plus, violinist Rachel Barton Pine and pianist Jenny Lynn are superfans of an overlooked Catalan composer. They'll play live. But we begin with Dr. Seuss. The new adaptation of his story, The Lorax, has been a box office hit. But Dr. Seuss himself wasn't so lucky back in 1953 when he released his very own movie musical called The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. The film was a flop. Seuss himself was even said to have called it a debaculous fiasco. But not everyone agreed, and it has since gathered a devoted following that includes the musician and music historian Michael Feinstein, who's here with me in the studio. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you, John.
So, how did you first encounter this film?
I was living in Los Angeles, and I read about a screening that was going to be given at the L.A. County Museum of Art of this forgotten Dr. Seuss Frederick Hollander musical that starred Peter Lynn Hayes, Mary Healy, and Hans Conried, who's acting and voice I loved. I was intrigued by the subject of the movie, which was about a child who has this dream about being taken prisoner by an evil piano professor.
Because he doesn't want to practice.
He doesn't want to practice. And so he falls into this I don't know if you call it a reverie, if it's a nightmare. But the story evolves about this piano teacher who takes all the other instruments in the orchestra prisoner so he can get 500 children to play his 5,000 key piano and gain dominance of the world. So I went to see this wacky film and was carried away by it. It was Stanley Kramer's first major production, and it was Dr. Seuss's first attempt to create anything that ambitious. And I loved the film, even though it clearly was flawed and in spots didn't make sense, but there still was genius in it.
The look of the film, it's so saturated in color. I mean, we think of Dr. Seuss as a purveyor of cartoons, of animation. It's almost as if they were attempting to do like a live-action animated cartoon sort of thing.
It does look like that because the sets are all designed by Dr. Seuss. He came up with the story in 1947, and so they worked on it for several years. And the scenic design, there's staircases that go up into the heavens and go nowhere, and all these odd geometric figures. So the whole thing has the sensibility of Dr. Seuss.
And this at a time when the name Dr. Seuss didn't really mean much, did it?
No, he was not very well known, even though he had won an Oscar the previous year for the animated cartoon Gerald McBoing Boing, which was about a child who only spoke in sound effects. And so that was his first acclaim, not only in Hollywood, but I think to the world. And then they made several sequels to Gerald McBoing Boing. So he was known for that. And so I guess that's what spurred Columbia Pictures to finally give the green light, that and the combination of Stanley Kramer, who was coming into prominence.
So this is pre-Cat in the Hat, pre-Green Eggs and Ham, way before The Grinch Stole Christmas
before
and The Lorax.
Before all of that, yes, long before.
And it was a flop. It was an inauspicious beginning to his career. I mean,
he himself, I mean, I love this, the kind of Seussian term, debaculous fiasco, whether he actually said that or not, we hear that secondhand, but he doesn't mention it in his memoir.
No, I think that it was painful for him because the amount of money that they spent on the film, ultimately they spent $2,700,000 on this movie. And it was supposed,
in 1953.
Yeah, in 52 actually. And it was supposed to be another Wizard of Oz, if you will. And it didn't preview well at all because they didn't know what it was. It wasn't really for kids. It wasn't for adults. It was sort of a morality play. It was about changing American family values.
Didn't they have stoners back in 1953?
Well, not enough, obviously. So they previewed the film, and they cut 9 of the 15 songs from the score. And the score, the music was composed by Friedrich Hollander, the great German composer who had...
Who was famous for?
Falling in Love Again. And all these scores he wrote for Marlene Dietrich here in the United States. And he was a marvelous composer, wrote songs and also wrote film scores. And he was the perfect guy to write this score.
Well, we're talking about a film called The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. People walked out of the premiere. And as we say, Dr. Seuss himself sort of all but disowned the film. And the movie opens with young Bart. He's seated at the piano, talking with his piano teacher, Dr. Terwilliger, and Bart is just not sure that the piano's for him.
I don't think the piano's my instrument.
What other instruments are there, pray tell? Scratchy violins, screechy piccolos, nauseating trumpets, etc., etc.? We'll make a Paderewski of you yet.
Who?
Paderewski.
Oh!
Now I want you to practice and practice and practice until you are perfect. Good day, young man.
All right, now, astute listeners will have heard some VHS noise in the background there. Our copy of the movie came from a VHS tape, which strangely is in the collection of our own technical director, Irene. Didn't think she was that kind of girl, but all right. It did have enough of a cult following to eventually come out on VHS, although it's not enough to apparently to be out on DVD. Is that right?
I think it is on DVD.
Oh, is it?
I think it is, but it's it was re-released in 1958 with the title Crazy Music, where they were trying to capture a new generation with it, and it didn't work then. But it has, through the years, achieved this extraordinary cult status.
So what you've done is to actually release 3 CDs of all the music. You mentioned many songs were cut. You've got all of the songs, all the alternate takes. And there are numbers like this one, the kid song, which captures that feeling of powerlessness that kids have in the face of their parents and piano teachers.
Now just because we're kids, because we're sort of small, because we're closer to the ground, and you are bigger pound by. And shove us little kids around. Now just because your throat has got a deeper voice and lots of wind to blow it out at little kids who don't dare shout, you have no right, you have no right to boss and beat us little kids about.
That is some of the music written by composer Friedrich Hollander and lyricist Dr. Seuss. The kids' song from the Dr. Seuss film The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. You can find a link to this 3-CD set that my guest Michael Feinstein has produced for the label Screen Archives on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Also on that page, you will find an excerpt from the film, an excerpt, in fact, Michael, from the dressing song.
Ah, that's the piece de resistance of the movie.
Now, what is so... I mean, you've actually recorded. This has moved you to actually do your own version of it.
Oh, yes.
What is there in this dressing song, which on the surface just... I mean, I don't remember the last time I heard the word spats in a song, but it's here.
It's in the movie. It's the scene where Dr. Terwilliger is getting dressed for his for his great moment when he's going to conduct the 500 kids in his masterwork. This is when he achieves dominance, and it's the epoch of his life's work, the finale, if you will. And it's a great number, and it's all this Dr. Seuss nonsense, and there he's being adorned by all these servants with all this finery, and it's just great vintage nonsense Dr. Seuss. So I had to find that song, and it was not published, and I went to Columbia Pictures and wangled my way into the old music department and got the music librarian to find the original orchestration for me, and she let me make a photocopy of it. I mean, I can't tell you how hard that was to get into a film studio and get in there. And they had thrown out a whole bunch of movie scores recently because they were getting rid of their old files. And I said,
and they
what?
Just throw them out?
They were the dumpsters. The days I were there, dumpsters were being filled with old scores. And I said, why are you throwing these away? She said, well, they're no good. I said, well, how do you determine that they're no good? And she had a copy of Leonard Maltin's book, Movies on Television. And if he gave the movie 2 stars or less, she threw away the score. So happily, for some reason, she saved 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, and I was able to get copies of the unpublished songs, the songs that were cut, and the dressing song.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Seuss was still alive at this time, right?
Yes. Well, this was somewhere in the mid-'80s, and then in 1989, when I had 5 minutes left at a recording session of something else, I had brought the music with me, I passed it out to the musicians, and we played it once through. Then there were like 3 minutes. We did one pass of it. I sang it live, and I got this recording of it. And I sent it to Dr. Seuss, and I wrote him a letter, and he wrote me back. And it's dated October 1989. It says, I've said, I hope you'll get a kick out of this. And he wrote, Dear Michael Feinstein, you are quite right. I did get a kick out of hearing your Dress Me song recording! Thank you very much for sending it. He said, Freddie Hollander, the composer, left the USA shortly after the picture was released and hasn't been heard from since.
Well, in fact, Hollander did go back to Germany after this and, you know, worked on, like, apparently theater pieces and stuff. But,
yes.
Yeah, this was not a good moment for either of them back in 1953 when the movie first came out. But let's hear the original version of the dressing song from Dr. Seuss's 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, and then a little bit of the Michael Feinstein version.
Dress me in my finest array, 'cause just in case you haven't heard, today's Domino Day. Dress me in my silver garters, dress me in my diamond studs, 'cause I'm going domi-doing in my domi-do duds. I want my undulating undies with the marabou frills. I want my beautiful bolero with the porcupine quills.
I want my purple nylon girdle with the orange blossom buds, 'cause I'm going domi-doing in my domi-do duds. Come on and dress me, dress me, dress me in my peekaboo blouse with the lovely interlining made of Chesapeake mouse. I want my polka dotted dickie with the crinoline fringe, for I'm going domi-doing on a domi-do binge. I want my lavender spats, and in addition...
That is Michael Feinstein's recording of the dressing song, or as Ted Geisel, Dr. Seuss, wrote in his letter to you, the Dress Me song?
He referred to it as that. I've never seen it referred to elsewhere as that.
So it's the dressing song. We heard a little bit of the original from the film, The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. Once again, music by Frederick Hollander, lyrics by Dr. Seuss. And soundcheck listeners... Have you seen The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T? I'd be curious to know what you think of it, whether you saw it in theaters in 1953 or maybe in a dorm room in 1985. You can leave a comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck, or give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 433-9692. Seems like an optimistic question to pose to listeners, but anytime soundcheck audience always amazes me. I'm sure there are people listening who have had the experience, Michael, that you've had of seeing the film and responding to it, although very few people would have spent 30 years tracking down all the stuff. I mean, this is kind of a quixotic journey you've been on.
Yes. Well, one of the great things of living part-time in Los Angeles is that one can find all kinds of artifacts relating to films, to musical films particularly. And I started collecting things, which I'd find at estate sales, old bookshops, old garages, and sometimes when I can wangle my way into studios. And I started looking for the songs that were cut from the film because of...
How did you know there were cuts?
Well, because that was part of the thing that they wrote in the description of the movie at the screening at the L.A. County Museum. And it was one of those massacred masterpieces, supposedly, and I always wanted to hear the additional work. When I met Stanley Kramer, I asked him about it, and he told me he tried to take his name off the film. He was so devastated at the way that it was butchered, the way it was cut. So I'm a completist, you know. So I started finding different artifacts, but it did take 30 years. One track, a demo of Hollander himself playing the piano, I found quite by accident at the used record store of an old guy named Music Man Murray, wonderful guy.
That's a Hollywood name, isn't it?
Music Man Murray. His real name's Murray Gershens. He's a great guy. Now an actor. And I got things from Peter Lind Hayes and Mary Healy, who were in the film. And I got things from the estate of Paul Mertz, who worked on the movie, mm-hmm. and then a Canadian collector. And it just was piece by piece. And there were certain things that were elusive. But eventually, I'd say 99% of it turned up.
Mm. So. And the results are out on this 3-CD set. The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. You find a link to the set on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. In this scene from the film, Bart, our dreaming or nightmaring young piano prodigy, has disobeyed Dr. Terwilliger and has been sent to the dungeon where he learns the fate of a misbehaving drummer.
I'm sure you'll find this the most fascinating dungeon. That lovely rumbling sound you hear is one of my favorite prisoners. He was a bass drummer in an orchestra I once conducted, had a very bad habit. You know that part in Beethoven's Fifth Symphony where the drummer is supposed to go a boom, 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 boom? Well, this stupid lout always went a boom, 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 a boom. One extra boom, you know. He'll be here forever.
You mean he has to keep beating that drum forever?
Oh, that isn't the man I'm punishing. My man is inside the drum.
Let me out! And I'm sure you're eager to get settled in your cage. Now let me see. Where do we have a vacancy?
Dr. Terwilliger. Boy, kids know that piano teachers are pure evil, and this movie simply proves the point.
It captured something, indeed.
Michael Feinstein, the musician and music historian, is with me here in the Soundcheck studio. We're talking about the film The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T with Dr. Seuss's Lorax, well on its way to being a box office hit. This is the other side of Dr. Seuss's career. It was also the start of the career of the Oscar-winning actor and dancer George Chakiris, who appeared in the film as a dancing trombone before going on to win an Oscar as Bernardo, leader of the Sharks, in the film version of West Side Story. And George is on the line with us from L.A. Hi, George.
Hi, Michael. How fascinating to hear all this stuff. It's so terrific. Wow, how educational and beautiful. Thank you.
Did you guys talk during, Michael, your 30-year quest?
Yes. As a matter of fact, George, you remember one night you were over the house and we screened the film and you pointed out where you were in that dungeon.
Yes,
ballet.
I do remember that, absolutely, yeah.
Now, George, how did you get involved in the film and get involved as a dancing trombone?
Well, the choreographer of 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T was Eugene Loring, and his school, the American School of Dance on Hollywood Boulevard, was the first place I had gone to take study dancing. And in fact, it was about 6 months after my first class that I was hired to be one of the male dancers in this sequence, the dungeon sequence. Because I was a student at the American School of Dance, it did give me the opportunity to audition. And so I got to be one of the guys, and I was very nervous. It was my first job, and I think I broke a trombone in one take and thought I was going to be reprimanded. I wasn't, but I came about it really through the coincidence, the very nice coincidence of having gone to the American School of Dance, run by Eugene Loring, and then it was Mr. Loring who choreographed 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T.
And so this is your Hollywood debut, and it involves you being green. How did that happen?
Being green, yes. Every morning, we were all sprayed green. It was, I guess that should be humiliating or something, but it wasn't. It was just, hey, yeah, we were sprayed green every morning, and after lunch, we were sprayed green again to, because it, you know, didn't stay in places that I guess ideally it should have. But, yeah, we were sprayed green. It was being, yeah, it's not easy being green, right?
Well, did you sing, Am I Green? Am I green?
Am I green? Right. But it was. I love the fact that I was one of the guys in that musical sequence, because this film has been a cult film for such a long time. Mm-hmm. I've had people get in touch with me asking me if I have one of the beanie hats.
Oh, the kids, yes.
You know, with a little
the beanie with the hand coming out of the top.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And people asking me for call sheets, things like that. So, but I mean, from quite some time ago. So, I learned quite some time ago that about the cult following. And by the way, I have seen this film recently, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I love Tommy Riddick. I think he's so adorable and wonderful in this Hans Conried. And I look forward, Michael, to seeing what you've done, this collection. How fantastic.
Well, I'll make sure you get one. I actually I was involved in the production, but I wasn't the sole producer. It was Mike Medicino and Neil Balk. So mm-hmm. I want to mention that.
Three CDs, a lot of work went into this.
Oh, boy, yes.
George Chakiris is on the line with us. He appeared in the film as a dancing trombone. And in the scene, he and the rest of the green kids dance to this song, the Dungeon Schlim Schlam. Dungeon Schlim Schlam, music by Frederick Hollander, a noted composer from Germany who spent some years in America, long enough to write some great songs for Marlene Dietrich, and this music for Dr. Seuss and the film The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. George Chakiris, the actor or Oscar-winning actor on the line with us from L.A., made his Hollywood debut in this scene as a dancing trombone, and Michael Feinstein has resurrected all the music for a new 3CD set, The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. And we've got lots of calls and comments of people who remember, Michael, remember this film, and so we'll get to some of those in just a moment. This is Soundcheck. So more on the 1953 flop turned cult hit, Dr. Seuss's 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. Your calls and comments next. And then later on, a live performance of some overlooked and underrepresented music from Catalonia in Spain. Violinist Rachel Barton Pine and pianist Jenny Lynn will join us later on Soundcheck.
Porcupine quills, I want my purple nylon girdle with the orange blossom buds, cause I'm going domey-doing in my domey-do-duds.
My guest, Michael Feinstein, performing the dressing song from the 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, 1953 flop of a film from the pen of Dr. Seuss, with music by Frederick Hollander. Michael's with me here in the studio. We've also been speaking with George Chakiris, who would later go on to an illustrious career. An Oscar for his portrayal of Bernardo, leader of the Sharks in West Side Story, but who got his debut. His first appearance on screen was as a dancing trombone in this film. And there are calls, there are comments, and the common thread that I'm seeing in many of them is, I can't believe I'm hearing this. I
mean, isn't that wonderful?
So I mean, George, let me ask you. I mean, did you think that, you know, 50-odd years later, you would still be talking about this film that threatened to just disappear the weekend it opened?
No, God, I'm sure no one ever considered thought anything like that. But it's fantastic that it's happening. It's a wonderful, wonderful piece, I think.
Well, George, it's been a real pleasure having you with us on Soundcheck. We're going to move on to some other calls, but thank you so much for sharing your experience with us.
Thank you very much. Hello, Michael. Nice to hear you.
You too. I'll talk to you soon.
And
okay.
Anne from Manhattan has seen the film. Anne, when did you...
I saw it when it came out. I was maybe finishing high school, and I went with my great high school boyfriend at the time, who was a pianist. I mean, he was a notable pianist. Everybody in the high school knew him for that. But for him, I would not have seen this picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I can still see scenes with a swirling keyboard and just the fantastical images. It was incredible.
The keyboard is, I mean, it's this long serpentine thing.
Yes, exactly. That's a good way to describe it. And there are all these little stools, and all the kids are placed at the keyboards, and they all have these beanies with a hand on top. And they did market those beanies, by the way. And they are true collectibles.
I bet they are. Lots of comments on the webpage. And so in a moment, we'll check in with Joel Meyer in the control room and get some of those. But first, back to the phones. Bishop on the line with us from Pittsburgh. Hey, Bishop, how are you?
I'm good, Sean. How are you?
Are you an actual bishop?
Yeah, I'm an archbishop, in fact.
Oh.
The Greek Orthodox Archbishop of Pittsburgh.
Well, what is your experience with this little film oddity we're discussing today?
I just have very vivid memories of being terrified by it.
That was the problem.
Yeah, I remember the dungeon song. I heard it once, and it seemed to have stuck with me for life. You know, first floor dungeon, and the sound made from that elixir that contained, was it the sorrow or the pain of all those kids?
It was like an atomic explosion at the end, yes.
Yeah, and just the first, that was my first experience of, like, synthesized sounds or backward tapes or whatever they used to make that thing, and it just, that too just spooked me.
How old were you?
I remember watching it on Chicago television. I was in Gary, Indiana at the time. And I was probably 8 or 9 years old.
Mm.
I think it was shown in the afternoon for the kids or something.
Now Michael, you said this was a common problem. I mean, this is a film that was marketed to kids, but it really wasn't a kids' film, was it?
It really wasn't. And it's hard to figure out what exactly they were trying to do with it, because it has echoes of the Cold War and worries about nuclear bomb and the destruction of the American family. One of the songs they cut was sung by Mary Healy, the little kid's mother, "Many questions have no answers and I can't tell you why," basically telling this kid that life doesn't turn out the way you want it to turn out. And they cut that, but still, the tone of the thing is very dark.
Mm. Well, here's a little bit of that song, of "Many Questions" from the 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T.
Some things are beyond explaining, and it's no use to try. Sure, I know you want the reasons why your world should seem so queer, why your little world should be so filled with so much fright and fear. Sure, I know you want to ask me, why must children suffer such pain?
Good night, Junior.
What is it?
That's not a kid song, is it?
Sure isn't.
Many Questions, one of the dark musical moments in The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, the Dr. Seuss flop musical of 1953. That is now available on the 3-CD set that Michael Feinstein has co-produced. And some of these songs, Michael, have been out there on a bootleg version.
Yeah, there was a bootleg LP that was actually taken from a cassette that I had. Somebody got a copy of it. And then it's put on – there was a CD that was put out.
So wait, the bootleg comes ultimately from you?
From a cassette that somebody copied of my – yeah. And it's
wow.
So they put a CD out of it. So Accept No Imitations, the 3-CD film score monthly, is the one that is the best sound and – studio authorized.
All right. Well, you've touched a nerve. Lots of comments, as well as the callers we've already heard from. Joel, what's on the comment page?
John, our listener Brad from the Upper West Side writes this: I saw this film when I was 6 in 1953. It scared me to death. Cheryl from City Island has not seen the movie, but she called in. She didn't post to the website. She called in to say the movie sounds awesome and that she's looking it up online right now. And maybe there's time for a quick question for Michael Feinstein. Our listener B. Page writes, the main child character is named Bart? And did they say the villain was named Terwilliger? That's the last name of Sideshow Bob. Is there a Simpsons connection here I wasn't aware of?
Well, I would guess that there is. I mean, I don't know the definitive answer to that, but I would assume that that this movie heavily influenced the creators of The Simpsons on many levels.
Through some sort of smoky haze, that kind of influence has emerged. We've been talking about The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. The Lorax is in theaters now and doing real well, but to find The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, you'd do well to check out Michael Feinstein's 3-CD set that he has produced on the Screen Archives label. There's a link on our webpage, along with lots of interesting comments, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Michael, great to see you again. Thanks
you too,
for being with
Thank
us.
Thank you. This was a blast.
This is Soundcheck.
We're vicious and mean. Unkind and unkempt and untrue. We'll have been that way.
Still to come, we celebrate the centennial of a Spanish composer who you've probably never heard of. Violinist Rachel Barton Pine and pianist Jenny Lynn will perform live next on Soundcheck.
Siamese beers with a twin on the chair.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The Catalonia region of Spain, which includes Barcelona, has turned out well-known artists like the famed cellist Pablo Casals, the surrealist painter Salvador Dali. But a lot of 20th century Catalan culture was repressed under the Spanish dictator Francisco Franco, which perhaps is why you have not heard of the Catalan composer Javier Monsalvatge. This month, the composer would have turned 100, and to celebrate his centennial, a new recording of his music has been released. And here to perform some of it for us today are two of the artists who appear on that record, violinist Rachel Barton Pine and pianist Jenny Lynn. This is the duo, live in our studio, with an excerpt from Javier Monsalvatge's Poema Concertante for violin and orchestra in a violin-piano arrangement, live on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
Rachel Barton Pine playing the violin, Jenny Lynn at the piano, and that's an excerpt and an arrangement of an excerpt from the Poema Concertante, originally for violin and orchestra, by this Catalan composer, Javier Monsalvace. And Rachel, Jenny, you've both been here before. It's great to have the two of you together.
Great to be here.
Jenny, this is a recent phenomenon. I mean, you're both on the record of Monsalvace's music, but separately.
Yes,
exactly. We didn't even cross paths in Germany because I was 6 months pregnant at the time, so I was just like a quick in and out. And so it's great to get the opportunity to play together.
By the way, Rachel, congratulations. So if you were 6 months pregnant then, it must have been about, what, almost a year ago. Your child is six months now?
Six months old? Sylvia just turned 6 months old.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, how new is this mid-20th century music to the two of you? I mean, Rachel, had you been aware of Monsalvace before this?
Never heard of the guy until I was invited to make this CD. But I'm really happy to discover him, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. And Jenny, what about you?
Well, I have made a CD of Federico Monpu's music.
Another great Catalan composer.
Yeah, and Monpu was a good friend of Monsalvace, so I knew his piano music.
Good friend of who?
Of Monsalvace, which I pronounced it with a...
There are so many. I mean, you're giving it a more giving it a more Catalan pronunciation.
I'm not even going to try it.
Yeah, I'm just going with Monsalvace because you know the real pronunciation looks nothing like the way it's spelled.
No,
You know, it's funny. I found out about him through the same composer, Monpu.
Yes.
Those great Musica Callada pieces.
Yes, they were great friends. Yeah.
What was it about these Catalan composers that they were so gifted and so unknown? Was it a function of being Catalan in Franco's Spain?
Oh, absolutely. I think they had to deal with a lot of issues. And their public life and private life were very much under scrutiny all the time. Very similar to what happened, you know, during Soviet Union and those composers.
Mm-hmm. There's we have a picture on our website, wnyc.org/soundcheck, where you can see Monsalvace at what I assume is his piano. It looks like he's in, like, you know, some dive bar or something. You know, the wall is all cracked and peeling, and it's an upright piano, and he's got a battered hat, and the cigarette is dangling from his mouth. He looks a little like Gershwin, actually.
A little.
But, you know, you don't get the impression that this was a guy who was maybe living particularly well, you know, that he was, like, burnishing his international reputation or anything like that.
Well, I think, like most artists during that regime, they had to fight a lot and they struggle a lot, but you know, because things were so difficult, they went out of their way to create their art, and mm-hmm. they made sure that somehow it's heard, somehow people know about it.
Yeah, Rachel, as someone who, you know, just discovered his music through this project, you know, what do you hear in this? What?
Well, first of all, structurally, this piece for violin and orchestra is really fascinating because it starts with an orchestral tutti, which, of course, we skipped just now in our Reader's Digest condensed version. But there's a brief orchestral tutti, and then there's an extended, very long, substantive cadenza for the violin. And then the orchestra comes in and plays with the violinist for the second half of the piece. And the only piece similar to that I can think of in the entire violin repertoire is Ravel's Zagan, which, of course, the first half is an unaccompanied cadenza. No opening tutti, but unaccompanied first half.
Cadenza simply meaning a solo, basically.
Right, and apparently Henrik Schering had asked the composer,
great violinist,
Monsalvace, okay, now I said it. He asked him to write this piece as sort of an alternative to Chasson's poem, which Schering was asked to play so frequently that he was growing a little bit sick of it.
Mm-hmm.
But this piece is really not very much like Chasson's poem at all. The Chasson poem is mostly lyrical, with some, you know, very intensely emotive passages, but this one also, the Poema Concertante of Monsalvace, also has some virtuoso passages of a type that you don't see in the Chasson poem. Mm. So I think it could just as easily take the place of Ravel's Zagan in terms of ending with some fireworks. And
so you think this could be a violinist's repertoire piece?
Absolutely. I think it would, you know, always when orchestras are programming their concerts, you know, one of the things is, okay, what's going to sell tickets? But, you know, this is exactly the kind of piece that could be paired with a more well-known. You could do a Dvorak romance plus this, or you could do this plus a Ravel Zagan or a Carmen Fantasy.
And the classical music world loves anniversaries, right? And it's his 100th anniversary this year. So this is the time.
Yeah, well, of course, now orchestras are programming their 15 seasons. But I'm hoping that with the release of the CD that more artists will take up this piece and more orchestras will program it, because it really deserves to be heard for sure.
The CD is called Monsalvace, Canciones y Conciertos, Songs and Concertos. It's out now and includes performances from both of my guests, the violinist Rachel Barton Pine and the pianist Jenny Lin. There's also a new biography of the composer Javier Monsalvace out now by Roger Evans, and it's called Javier Monsalvace, A Musical Life in Eventful Times. Again, he was a Catalan composer from the region of Catalonia, which was full of a kind of bubbling ferment of ill will towards the dictator, Francisco Franco, in Spain in the mid-century. Jenny, you're going to play a bit of the Concerto Breve, the short concerto by Monsalvace.
Yes.
Obviously, just the piano part.
I'm going to do an excerpt of the cadenza leading into the last movement. So there's a little bit of orchestra missing, but that was the best way I felt to end.
Okay. Let's hear Jenny Lin in a live performance. It's music by Javier Monsalvace, live on Soundcheck. Nice. Jenny Lin at our piano and music by the Catalan composer Javier Monsalvace. It's his centennial year this year. The Concerto Breve is originally for piano and orchestra. Just a little bit of the piano part there, Jenny. There are a couple of moments, the sort of watery figure in the right hand and the tolling chords in the left hand that recall Debussy.
Absolutely. He was very much inspired by Debussy and Ravel. If you listen to the second movement, I think it's one of the most beautiful movements for piano concerto literature. And it reminds you of Ravel Piano Concerto, as well as a lot of the harmonic writing is very Debussy.
Now, Catalonia is the region of Spain that is, it's up towards the north, again, where Barcelona is. So it's getting towards the French border. So
yes.
You have that, maybe some of that influence.
I actually heard Dr. Seuss in a bit of that.
Now, is that because you were listening to the first half of the show?
Maybe.
And we just put you in line? What about, you know, it's not just the French influence, but like Rachel in the piece you and Jenny are going to play next, there's this from a series of, he calls it Five Black Songs, and there's kind of a Cuban thing at play here, isn't there?
Yeah, well, there's that habanera rhythm that we know from Bizet's Carmen, the dum, ba dum, bum, bum. Not what you would normally find in a lullaby, but it works.
Oh, so this is a lullaby.
Exactly. Well, what we're playing, what we're going to play next is on this same album with the piano concerto and the poema for violin and orchestra is also a song cycle with vocalist and orchestra. But Monsalvaje himself arranged, I think, the fourth of those songs for violin and piano, and it's called Lullaby. And, well, I don't know if being a mother has made my interpretations of instrumental lullabies any better, but definitely my appreciation for them has deepened.
All right. Let's see how it sounds. And baby Sylvia is right outside the studio, isn't she?
Exactly. She's listening.
Listening in. All right. Rachel Barton Pine playing the violin. Jenny Lynn at our piano. Here is The Lullaby by Javier Monsalvaje. That is a live performance in our studio by violinist Rachel Barton Pine and pianist Jenny Lynn of music from the Catalan composer Javier Monsalvaje, his lullaby for violin and piano. And Rachel, Jenny, it's great that you're here sort of telling people about Monsalvaci and his music and playing it for us today. Thank you so much for being here with us on Soundcheck.
Well, thank you for helping us spread the word.
Thank you.
The album's called Monsalvaci, Canciones y Conciertos, and it's out now. And that's going to do it for Soundcheck today. On our next program, fans are lining up to see The Hunger Games. The movie opens tonight in theaters across the country. But the soundtrack has been selling like gangbusters. We'll hear all about it and talk about other great music inspired by dismal predictions of the future. And a live performance from the folk band Bowerbirds. Tomorrow on Soundcheck.